immediately that things were not going well in the drawing room without him. Darya Alexandrovna, in her best gray silk gown, obviously worried about the children who were to have their dinner by themselves in the nursery, and by her husband's absence, was not equal to the task of making the party mix without him. All were sitting like so many priest daughters on a visit, so the old prince expressed it, obviously wondering why they were there, and pumping up remarks simply to avoid being silent. Turovtsin, good-hearted man, felt unmistakably like a fish out of water, and the smile with which his thick lips greeted Stepan Arkadyevich said, as plainly as words, "Well, old boy, you have popped me down in a learned set. A drinking party in the Chateau de Fleurs would be more in my line." The old prince sat in silence, his bright little eyes watching Karenin with a sidelong look. And Stepan Arkadyevich saw that he had already formed a sharp remark to sum up that politician of whom guests had been invited to partake, as though he were a sturgeon. Kitty was looking at the door, calling up all her energies to keep her from blushing at the entrance of Konstantin Levin. Young Shcherbatsky, who had not been introduced to Karenin, was trying to look as though he were not in the least embarrassed by it. Karenin himself had followed the Petersburg etiquette for a dinner with ladies present and was wearing evening dress and a white tie. Stepan Arkadyevich saw by his face that he had come simply to keep his promise and was performing a disagreeable duty in being present at this gathering. He was indeed the person chiefly responsible for the chill benumbing all the guests before Stepan Arkadyevich came. On entering the drawing room, Stepan Arkadyevich apologized, explaining that he had been detained by that prince, who was always a scapegoat for all his absences and unpunctualities, and in one moment he had made all the guests acquainted with each other, and bringing together Alexei Alexandrovich and Sergei Koznishev, had started them on a discussion of the Russification of Poland, into which they immediately plunged with Pestov. Slapping Turovtsin on the shoulder, he whispered something comic in his ear and set him down by his wife and the old prince. Then he told Kitty she was looking very pretty that evening and presented Shcherbatsky to Karenin. In a moment he had so kneaded together the social dough that the drawing room became very lively, and there was a merry buzz of voices. Konstantin Levin was the only person who had not arrived. But this was so much the better, as going into the dining room, Stepan Arkadyevich found to his horror that the port and sherry had been procured from Dipre, and not from Lviv, and directing that the coachman should be sent off as speedily as possible to Lviv, he started back to the drawing room. In the dining room, he was met by Konstantin Levin. "I'm not late?" "You can never help being late," said Stepan Arkadyevich, taking his arm. "Have you a lot of people? Who's here?" asked Levin, unable to help blushing, as he knocked the snow off his cap with his glove. "All are set. Kitty's here. Come along. I'll introduce you to Karenin." Stepan Arkadyevich, for all his liberal views, was well aware that to meet Karenin was sure to be felt a flattering distinction, and so treated his best friend to this honor. But at that instant, Konstantin Levin was not in a condition to feel all the gratification of making such an acquaintance. He had not seen Kitty since that memorable evening when he met Vronsky, not counting, that is, the moment when he had had a glimpse of her on the high road. He had known at the bottom of his heart that he would see her here today, but to keep his thoughts free, he had tried to persuade himself that he did not know it. Now, when he heard that she was here, he was suddenly conscious of such delight, and at the same time of such dread, that his breath failed him and he could not utter what he wanted to say. "What is she like? What is she like? As she used to be, or as she was in the carriage? What if Darya Alexandrovna told the truth? Why shouldn't it be the truth?" he thought. "Oh, please, introduce me to Karenin," he brought out with an effort. And with a desperately determined step, he walked into the drawing room and beheld her. She was not the same as she used to be. nor was she as she had been in the carriage. She was quite different. She was scared, shy, shamefaced, and because of all this, still more charming. She saw him the very instant he walked into the room. She had been expecting him. She was delighted, and so confused at her own delight that there was a moment, the moment when he went up to her sister and glanced again at her, when she and he and Dolly, who saw it all, thought she would break down and begin to cry. She crimsoned, turned white, crimsoned again, and grew faint, waiting with quivering lips for him to come to her. He went up to her, bowed, and held out his hand without speaking. Except for the slight quiver of her lips and the moisture in her eyes, making them brighter, her smile was almost calm as she said, "How long it is since we've seen each other." And with desperate determination, with her cold hand, squeezed his. "You've not seen me, but I've seen you," said Levin with a radiant smile of happiness. "I saw you when you were driving from the railway station in Ergushova." "When?" she asked, wondering. "You were driving to Ergushova," said Levin, feeling as if he would sob with the rapture that was flooding his heart. "And how dared I associate a thought of anything not innocent in this touching creature? And yes, I do believe what Darya Alexandrovna told me is true," he thought. Stepan Arkadyevitch took him by the arm and led him away to Karenin. "Let me introduce you." He mentioned their names. "Very glad to meet you," said Alexey Alexandrovich coldly, shaking hands with Levin. "You are acquainted?" Stepan Arkadyevitch asked in surprise. "We spent 3 hours together in the train," said Levin, smiling, "but got out, just as in a masquerade, quite mystified. At least I was." "Oh, so that's it. Come along, please," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, pointing in the direction of the dining room. The men went into the dining room and went up to the table for hors d'oeuvres, laid with 6 sorts of vodka and as many kinds of cheese, some with little silver spades and some without, caviar, herrings, preserves of various kinds, and plates with slices of French bread. The men stood round the strong-smelling spirits and salt delicacies, and the discussion of the Russification of Poland between Koznishev, Karenin, and Pestsov died down in anticipation of dinner. Sergei Ivanovich was unequaled in his skill in winding up the most heated and serious argument by some unexpected pitch of added salt that changed the disposition of his opponent. He did this now. Alexey Alexandrovich had been maintaining that the Russification of Poland could only be accomplished as a result of greater principles, which ought to be introduced by the Russian government. Pestsov insisted that one country can absorb another only when it is the more densely populated. Koznishev admitted both points, but with limitations. As they were going out of the drawing room to conclude the argument, Koznishev said, smiling, "So, then, for the Russification of our foreign populations, there is but one method, to bring up as many children as one can. My brother and I are terribly at fault, I see. You married men, especially you, Stepan Arkadyevitch, are the real patriots. What number have you reached?" he said, smiling genially at their host and holding out a tiny wine glass to him. Everyone laughed, and Stepan Arkadyevitch with particular good humor. "Oh, yes, that's the best method," he said, munching cheese and filling the wine glass with a special sort of vodka. The conversation dropped at the jest. "This cheese is not bad. Shall I give you some?" said the master of the house. "Why, have you been going in for gymnastics again?" he asked Levin, pinching his muscle with his left hand. Levin smiled, bent his arm, and under Stepan Arkadyevich's fingers the muscle swelled up like a sound cheese, hard as a knob of iron, through the fine cloth of the coat. "What biceps! A perfect Samson!" "I imagine great strength is needed for hunting bears," observed Alexey Alexandrovich, who had the mistiest notions about the chase. He cut off and spread with cheese a wafer of bread, fine as a spider web. Levin smiled. "Not at all, quite the contrary. A child can kill a bear," he said, with a slight bow, moving aside for the ladies who were approaching the hors d'oeuvres table. "You have killed a bear, I've been told," said Kitty, trying assiduously to catch with her fork a perverse mushroom that would slip away, and shaking the lace over her white arm. "Are there bears on your place?" she added, turning her charming little head to him and smiling. There was apparently nothing extraordinary in what she said, but what unutterable means there was for him in every sound, in every turn of her lips, her eyes, her hand as she said it. There was entreaty for forgiveness and trust in him, and tenderness, soft, timid tenderness, and promise and hope and love for him, which he could not but believe in, and which suffocated him with happiness. "No, we've been hunting in the Tver province. It was coming back from there that I met your beau-frère in the train, or your beau-frère's brother-in-law," he said with a smile. It was an amusing meeting. And he began telling with droll good humor how, after not sleeping all night, he had, wearing a fur-lined, full-skirted coat, got into Alexei Alexandrovich's compartment. "The conductor, forgetting the proverb, would have chucked me out on account of my attire. But thereupon I began expressing my feelings in elevated language, and you too," he said, addressing Karenin and forgetting his name, "at first would have ejected me on the ground of my coat, but afterward you took my part, for which I am extremely grateful. The rights of passengers generally to choose their seats are too ill-defined," said Alexei Alexandrovich, rubbing the tips of his fingers on his handkerchief. "I saw you were in uncertainty about me," said Levin, smiling good-naturedly, "but I made haste to plunge into intellectual conversation to smooth over the defects of my attire." Sergei Ivanovich, while he kept the conversation with their hostess, had one ear for his brother, and he glanced askance at him. "What is the matter with him today? Why such a conquering hero?" he thought. He did not know that Levin was feeling as though he had grown wings. Levin knew she was listening to his words and that she was glad to listen to him. And this was the only thing that interested him. Not in that room only, but in the whole world, there existed for him only himself, with enormously increased importance and dignity in his own eyes, and she. He felt himself on a pinnacle that made him giddy, and far away down below were all those kind, excellent Karenins, Oblonskys, and all the world. Quite without attracting notice, without glancing at them, as though they were no other places left, Stepan Arkadyevich put Levin and Kitty side by side. "Oh, you may as well sit there," he said to Levin. The dinner was as choice as the china, of which Stepan Arkadyevich was a connoisseur. The soup Marie Louise was a splendid success. The tiny patties eaten with it melted in the mouth and were irreproachable. The two footmen and Matvey, in white cravats, did their duty with the dishes and wines unobtrusively, quietly, and dexterously. On the material side, the dinner was a success. It was no less so on the immaterial. The conversation, at times general and at times between individuals, never paused, and toward the end the company was so lively that the men rose from the table without stopping speaking, and even Alexei Alexandrovich became lively. Chapter 10 Pestsov liked freshening an argument out to the end and was not satisfied with Sergei Ivanovich's words, especially as he felt the injustice of his view. "I did not mean," he said over the soup, addressing Alexei Alexandrovich, "mere density of population alone, but in conjunction with fundamental ideas, and not by means of principles." "It seems to me," Alexei Alexandrovich said languidly and with no haste, "that that's the same thing. In my opinion, influence over another people is only possible to the people which has the higher development, which..." "But that's just the question," Pestsov broke in his face. He was always in a hurry to speak and seemed always to put his whole soul into whatever he was saying. "Of what are we to make higher development consist? The English, the French, the Germans, which is at the highest state of development? Which of them will nationalize the other? We see the Rhine provinces have been turned French. Yet the Germans are not at a lower stage," he shouted. "There is another law at work there. I fancy that the greater influence is always on the side of true civilization, said Alexey Alexandrovich, slightly lifting his eyebrows. But what are we to lay down as the outward signs of true civilization, said Pestov. I imagine such signs are generally very well known, said Alexey Alexandrovich. But are they fully known? Sergey Ivanovich put in with a subtle smile. It is the accepted view now that real culture must be purely classical. But we see most intense disputes on each side of the question, and there is no denying that the opposite camp has strong points in its favor. You are for the classics, Sergey Ivanovich? Will you take red wine, said Stepan Arkadyevich? I am not expressing my own opinion of either form of culture, Sergey Ivanovich said, holding out his glass with a smile of condescension as to a child. I only say that both sides have strong arguments to support them, he went on, addressing Alexey Alexandrovich. My sympathies are classical from education, but in this discussion I am personally unable to arrive at a conclusion. I see no distinct grounds for classical studies being given a preeminence over scientific studies. The natural sciences have just as great an educational value, put in Pestov. Take astronomy, take botany, or zoology, with its system of general principles. I cannot quite agree with that, responded Alexey Alexandrovich. It seems to me that one must admit that the very process of studying the forms of language has a peculiarly favorable influence on intellectual development. Moreover, it cannot be denied that the influence of the classical authors is in the highest degree moral, while unfortunately with the study of the natural sciences are associated the false and noxious doctrines which are the curse of our day. Sergey Ivanovich would have said something, but Pestov interrupted him in his rich bass. He began warmly contesting the justice of this view. Sergey Ivanovich waited serenely to speak, obviously with a convincing reply ready. But, said Sergey Ivanovich, smiling subtly and addressing Karenin, one must allow that to weigh all the advantages and disadvantages of classical and scientific studies is a difficult task, and the question which form of education was to be preferred would not have been so quickly and conclusively decided if there had not been in favor of classical education, as you expressed it just now. Its moral descends le mot annihilist influence, undoubtedly. If it had not been for the distinctive property of anti-nihilistic influence on the side of classical studies, we should have considered the subject more, have weighed the arguments on both sides, said Sergey Ivanovich with a subtle smile. We should have given elbow room to both tendencies. But now we know that these little pills of classical learning possess the medicinal property of anti-nihilism, and we boldly prescribe them to our patients. But what if they had no such medicinal property? He added his pinch of Attic salt. At Sergey Ivanovich's little pills, everyone laughed. Tarasin, in especial, roared loudly and jovially, glad at last to have found something to laugh at, all he ever looked for in listening to conversation. Stepan Arkadyevich had not made a mistake in inviting Pestov. With Pestov, intellectual conversation never flagged for an instant. Directly Sergey Ivanovich had concluded the conversation with his jest, Pestov promptly started a new one. I can't agree even, said he, that the government had that aim. The government obviously is guided by abstract considerations and remains indifferent to the influence its measures may exercise. The education of women, for instance, would naturally be regarded as likely to be harmful, but the government opens schools and universities for women. And the conversation at once passed to the new subject of education of women. Alexey Alexandrovich expressed the idea that the education of women is apt to be confounded with the emancipation of women, and that it is only so that it can be considered dangerous. I consider, on the contrary, that the two questions are inseparably connected together, said Pestov. It is a vicious circle. Woman is deprived of rights from lack of education, and the lack of education results from the absence of rights. We must not forget that the subjection of women is so complete and dates from such distant ages that we are often unwilling to recognize the gulf that separates them from us, said he. You mentioned rites, said Sergei Ivanovich, waiting till Pestov had finished, meaning the right of sitting on juries, of voting, of presiding at councils, the right of entering the civil service, of sitting in parliament? Undoubtedly. But if women, as a rare exception, can occupy such positions, it seems to me you were wrong in using the expression rights. It would be more correct to say duties. Every man will agree that in doing the duty of a juryman, a witness, a telegraph clerk, we feel we are performing duties. And therefore it would be correct to say that women are seeking duties, and quite legitimately. And one can but sympathize with this desire to assist in the general labor of man. Quite so, Alexei Alexandrovich assented. The question, I imagine, is simply whether they are fitted for such duties. They will most likely be perfectly fitted, said Stepan Arkadyevich, when education has become general among them. We see this. How about the proverb, said the prince, who had a long while been intent on the conversation, his mocking little eyes twinkling. I can say it before my daughters. Her hair is long, but her wit is short. Just what they thought of the Negroes before their emancipation, said Pestov angrily. What seems strange to me is that women should seek fresh duties, said Sergei Ivanovich, while we see, unhappily, that men usually try to avoid them. Duties are bound up with rights, power, money, honor. Those are what women are seeking, said Pestov. Just as though I should seek the right to be a wet nurse and feel injured because women are paid for the work, while no one will take me, said the old prince. Kurovsin exploded in a loud roar of laughter, and Sergei Ivanovich regretted that he had not made this comparison. Even Alexei Alexandrovich smiled. Yes, but a man can't nurse a baby, said Pestov, while a woman... No, there was an Englishman who did suckle his baby on board ship, said the old prince, feeling this freedom in conversation permissible before his own daughters. There are as many such Englishmen as there would be women officials, said Sergei Ivanovich. Yes, but what is a girl to do who has no family, put in Stepan Arkadyevich, thinking of Masha Shibasova, whom he had had in his mind all along, and sympathizing with Pestov and supporting him. If the story of such a girl were thoroughly sifted, you would find she had abandoned the family, her own or a sister's, where she might have found a woman's duties. Darya Alexandrovna broke in unexpectedly in a tone of exasperation, probably suspecting what sort of girl Stepan Arkadyevich had in mind. But we take our stand on principle, on the ideal, replied Pestov in his sonorous bass. Woman desires to have the right to be independent, educated. She is oppressed, humiliated by the consciousness of her disabilities. And I'm oppressed and humiliated that they won't engage me at the foundling asylum, the old prince said again, to the huge delight of Turovsin, who, in his mirth, dropped his asparagus with the thick end in the sauce. Chapter 11. Everyone took part in the conversation except Kitty and Levin. At first, when they were talking of the influence that one people has on another, there rose in Levin's mind what he had to say on the subject. But these ideas, once of such importance in his eyes, seemed to come into his brain as in a dream, and had now not the slightest interest for him. It even struck him as strange that they should be so eager to talk of what was of no use to anyone. Kitty, too, one would have supposed, should have been interested in what they were saying of the rights and education of women. How often she had mused on the subject, thinking of her friend abroad, Varenka, of her painful state of dependence. How often she had wondered about herself as to what would become of her if she did not marry, and how often she had argued with her sister about it. But now it did not interest her at all. She and Levin had a conversation of their own. Yet, not a conversation, but a sort of mysterious communication, which brought them every moment nearer and stirred in both a sense of glad terror before the unknown into which they were entering. At first, Levin, in answer to Kitty's question, how he could have seen her last year in the carriage, told her that he had been coming home from the mowing along the high road and had met her. It was very, very early in the morning. You were probably only just awake. Your mama was asleep in her corner. It was an exquisite morning. I was walking along wondering who it could be in the four in hand. It was a splendid set of four horses with bells, and in a second you flashed by and I saw you at the window. You were sitting like this, holding the strings of your cap in both hands, in an awfully deep thought about something, he said, smiling. How I should like to know what you were thinking about then. Something important? Wasn't I dreadfully untidy? She wondered. But seeing the smile of ecstasy these reminiscences called up, she felt that the impression she had made had been very good. She blushed and laughed with delight. Really, I don't remember. How nicely Turovson laughs, said Levin, admiring his humid eyes and heaving chest. Have you known him long? Asked Kitty. Oh, everyone knows him. And I see you think he's a horrid man. Not horrid, but there's nothing in him. Oh, you're wrong, and you must give up thinking so directly, said Kitty. I used to have a very poor opinion of him, too, but he's an awfully fine and wonderfully good-hearted man. He has a heart of gold. How could you find out what sort of heart he has? We are great friends. I know him very well. Last winter, soon after you came to see us, she said, with a guilty and at the same time a confiding smile, all Dolly's children had scarlatina, and he happened to come to see her. And only fancy, she said in a whisper, he felt so sorry for her that he stayed and began to help her look after the children. Yes, and for 3 weeks he stopped with them and looked after the children like a nurse. I am telling Konstantin Dmitrievich about Turovson and the scarlatina, she said, bending over to her sister. Yes, it was wonderful, noble, said Dolly, glancing toward Turovson, who had become aware they were talking of him and smiling gently to him. Levin glanced once more at Turovson and wondered how it was he had not realized all this man's goodness before. I'm sorry, and I'll never think ill of people again, he said gaily, genuinely expressing what he felt at the moment. Chapter 12. Connected with the conversation that had sprung up on the rights of women, there were certain questions as to the inequality of rights in marriage, improper to discuss before the ladies. Pestsov had several times during dinner touched upon these questions, but Sergei Ivanovich and Stepan Arkadyevich carefully drew him off them. When they rose from the table and the ladies had gone out, Pestsov did not follow them, but addressing Alexei Alexandrovich began to expound the chief ground of inequality. The inequality in marriage, in his opinion, lay in the fact that the infidelity of the wife and the infidelity of the husband are punished unequally, both by the law and by public opinion. Stepan Arkadyevich went hurriedly up to Alexei Alexandrovich and offered him a cigar. No, I don't smoke, Alexei Alexandrovich answered calmly, and as though purposely wishing to show that he was not afraid of the subject, he turned to Pestsov with a chilly smile. I imagine that such a view has a foundation in the very nature of things, he said, and would have gone on to the drawing-room. But at this point, Turovson broke suddenly and unexpectedly into the conversation, addressing Alexei Alexandrovich. You heard, perhaps, about Priyanchnikov, said Turovson, warmed up by the champagne he had drunk and long waiting for an opportunity to break the silence that had weighed on him. Vasya Priyanchnikov, he said with a good-natured smile on his moist red lips, addressing himself principally to the most important guest, Alexei Alexandrovich. They told me today he fought a duel with Vitsy at Tver and has killed him. Just as it always seems that one bruises oneself on a sore place, so Stepan Arkadyevich felt now that the conversation would by ill luck fall at any moment on Alexei Alexandrovich's sore spot. He would again have got his brother-in-law away, but Alexei Alexandrovich himself inquired with curiosity. What did Priyanchnikov fight about? His wife acted like a man, he did, called him out and shot him. Ah, said Alexei Alexandrovich indifferently, and lifting his eyebrows he went into the drawing room. How glad I am you have come, Dolly said with a frightened smile, meeting him in the outer drawing room. I must talk to you. Let's sit here. Alexey Alexandrovich, with the same expression of indifference due to his lifted eyebrows, sat down beside Darya Alexandrovna and smiled affectedly. "It's fortunate," said he, "especially as I meant to ask you to excuse me and to be taking leave. I have to start tomorrow." Darya Alexandrovna was firmly convinced of Anna's innocence, and she felt herself growing pale and her lips quivering with anger at this frigid, unfeeling man who was so calmly intending to ruin her innocent friend. "Alexey Alexandrovich," she said with desperate resolution, looking him in the face, "I asked you about Anna. You made me no answer. How is she?" "She is, I believe, quite well, Darya Alexandrovna," replied Alexey Alexandrovich without looking at her. "Alexey Alexandrovich, forgive me, I have no right, but I love Anna as a sister and esteem her. I beg, I beseech you to tell me what is wrong between you. What fault do you find with her?" Alexey Alexandrovich frowned and, almost closing his eyes, dropped his head. "I presume that your husband has told you the grounds on which I consider it necessary to change my attitude to Anya Arkadyevna," he said without looking her in the face, but eyeing with displeasure Shcherbatsky, who was walking across the drawing room. "I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I can't believe it," Dolly said, clasping her bony hands before her with a vigorous gesture. She rose quickly and laid her hand on Alexey Alexandrovich's sleeve. "We shall be disturbed here. Come this way, please." Dolly's agitation had an effect on Alexey Alexandrovich. He got up and submissively followed her to the schoolroom. They sat down at a table covered with an oilcloth cut in slits by penknives. I don't believe it," Dolly said, trying to catch his glance, still avoiding her. "One cannot disbelieve facts, Darya Alexandrovna," said he, with an emphasis on the word facts. "But what has she done?" said Darya Alexandrovna. "What precisely has she done?" "She has forsaken her duty and deceived her husband. That's what she has done," said he. "No, no, it can't be. No, for God's sake, you are mistaken," said Dolly, putting her hands to her temples and closing her eyes. Alexey Alexandrovich smiled coldly with his lips alone, meaning to signify to her and himself the firmness of his conviction. But this warm defense, though it could not shake him, reopened his wound. He began to speak with greater heat. "It is extremely difficult to be mistaken when a wife herself informs her husband of the fact, informs him that 8 years of her life and a son are all a mistake, and that she wants to begin life anew," he said angrily and with a snort. "Anna and sin? I cannot connect them. I cannot believe it." "Darya Alexandrovna," he said, now looking straight into Dolly's kindly, troubled face, and feeling that his tongue was being loosened in spite of himself, "I would give a great deal for doubt to be still possible. When I doubted, I was miserable, but it was better than now. When I doubted, I had hope, but now there is no hope, and still I doubt everything. I am in such doubt of everything that I even hate my son, and sometimes do not believe he is my son. I am very unhappy." He had no need to say that. Darya Alexandrovna had seen that as soon as he glanced into her face, and she felt sorry for him, and her faith in the innocence of her friend began to waver. "Oh, this is awful, awful. But can it be true that you are resolved on a divorce?" "I am resolved on extreme measures. There is nothing else for me to do." "Nothing else to do. Nothing else to do," she replied, with tears in her eyes. "Oh, no, don't say there is nothing else to do," she said. "What is horrible in a misfortune of this kind is that one cannot, as in any other loss and death, bear one's trouble in peace, but that one must act," said he, as though guessing her thought. "One must get out of the humiliating position in which one is placed. One can't live a Troy." "I understand, I quite understand that," said Dolly, and her head sank. She was silent for a little, thinking of herself, of her own grief and her family, and all at once, with an impulsive movement, she raised her head and clasped her hands with an imploring gesture. "But wait a little. You are a Christian. Think of her. What will become of her if you cast her off?" I have thought, Darya Alexandrovna. I have thought a great deal, said Alexey Alexandrovich. His face turned red in patches, and his dim eyes looked straight before him. Darya Alexandrovna, at that moment, pitied him with all her heart. That, indeed, was what I did when she herself made known to me my humiliation. I left everything as of old. I gave her a chance to reform. I tried to save her. And with what result? She would not regard the least request that she should observe decorum, he said, getting heated. One may save anyone who does not want to be ruined, but if the whole nature is so corrupt, so depraved, that ruin itself seems to her salvation. What's to be done? Anything, only not divorce, answered Darya Alexandrovna. But what is anything? No, it is awful. She will be no one's wife. She will be lost. What can I do? Said Alexey Alexandrovich, raising his shoulders and his eyebrows. The recollection of his wife's last act had so incensed him that he had become frigid, as at the beginning of the conversation. I am very grateful for your sympathy, but I must be going, he said, getting up. No, wait a minute. You must not ruin her. Wait a little. I will tell you about myself. I was married, and my husband deceived me. In anger and jealousy, I would have thrown up everything. I would myself. But I came to myself again, and who did it? Anna saved me. And here I am, living on. The children are growing up. My husband has come back to his family and feels his fault is growing purer, better, and I live on. I have forgiven it, and you ought to forgive. Alexey Alexandrovich heard her, but her words had no effect on him now. All the hatred of that day when he had resolved on a divorce had sprung up again in his soul. He shook himself and said in a shrill, loud voice, "Forgive I cannot. I do not wish to, and I regard it as wrong. I have done everything for this woman, and she has trodden it all in the mud to which she is kin. I am not a spiteful man. I have never hated anyone, but I hate her with my whole soul, and I cannot even forgive her, because I hate her too much for all the wrong she has done me," he said with tears of hatred in his voice. "Love those that hate you," Darya Alexandrovna whispered timorously. Alexey Alexandrovich smiled contemptuously. That he knew long ago, but it could not be applied to his case. "Love those that hate you, but to love those one hates is impossible. Forgive me for having troubled you. Everyone has enough to bear in his own grief." And regaining his self-possession, Alexey Alexandrovich quietly took leave and went away. Chapter 13. When they rose from the table, Levin would have liked to follow Kitty into the drawing room, but he was afraid she might dislike this, as too obviously paying her attention. He remained in the little ring of men taking part in the general conversation, and without looking at Kitty, he was aware of her movements, her looks, and the place where she was in the drawing room. Best effort, keep the promise he had made her, always to think well of all men and to like everyone always. The conversation fell on the village commune, in which Pestov saw a sort of special principle, called by him the choral principle. Levin did not agree with Pestov, nor with his brother, who had a special attitude of his own, both admitting yet not admitting the significance of the Russian commune. But he talked to them, simply trying to reconcile and soften their differences. He was not in the least interested in what he said himself, and even less so in what they said. All he wanted was that they and everyone should be happy and contented. He knew now the one thing of importance, and that one thing was at first there in the drawing room, and then began moving across and came to a standstill at the door. Without turning round, he felt her eyes fixed on him and her smile, and he could not help turning around. She was standing in the doorway with Shcherbatsky, looking at Levin. "I thought you were going toward the piano," said he, going up to her. "That's something I miss in the country, music." "No, we only came to fetch you, and I thank you," she said, rewarding him with a smile that was like a gift, "for coming." "What do they want to argue for? No one ever convinces anyone, you know. Yes, that's true, said Levin. It generally happens that one argues warmly simply because one can't make out what one's opponent wants to prove. Levin had often noticed in discussions between the most intelligent people that after enormous efforts and an enormous expenditure of logical subtleties and words, the disputants finally arrived at the realization that what they had so long been struggling to prove to one another had long ago, from the beginning of the argument, been known to both, but that they liked different things and would not define what they liked for fear of its being attacked. He had often had the experience of suddenly grasping in a discussion what it was his opponent liked and at once liking it too, and immediately he found himself agreeing, and then all arguments fell away as useless. Sometimes, too, had he experienced the opposite, expressing at last what he liked himself, which he was devising arguments to defend, and chancing to express it well and genuinely, he had found his opponent at once agreeing and ceasing to dispute his position. He tried to say this. She knit her brow, trying to understand, but directly he began to illustrate his meaning, she understood at once. I know one must find out what he is arguing for and what is precious to him. Then one can, she had completely guessed and expressed his badly expressed idea. Levin smiled joyfully. He was struck by this transition from the confused, verbose discussion with Pestov and his brother to this laconic, clear, almost wordless communication of the most complex ideas. Shcherbatsky moved away from them, and Kitty, going up to a card table, sat down, and taking up the chalk, began drawing diverging circles over the new green cloth. They began again on the subject that had been started at dinner, the liberty and occupations of women. Levin was of the opinion of Darya Alexandrovna that a girl who did not marry should find a woman's duties in a family. He supported this view by the fact that no family can get on without women to help, that in every family, poor or rich, there are and must be nurses, either relations or hired. No, said Kitty, blushing, but looking at him all the more bravely with her truthful eyes. A girl may be so circumstanced that she cannot live in the family without humiliation, while she herself, at the hint, he understood her. Oh, yes, he said, yes, 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 you're right, you're right. And he saw all that Pestov had been maintaining at dinner about the liberty of woman, simply from getting a glimpse of the terror of an old maid's existence and its humiliation in Kitty's heart. And loving her, he felt that terror and humiliation and at once gave up his arguments. A silence followed. She was still drawing with the chalk on the table. Her eyes were shining with a soft light. Under the influence of her mood, he felt in all his being a continually growing tension of happiness. Ah, I've scribbled all over the table, she said, and laying down the chalk, she made a movement as though to get up. What? Shall I be left alone without her, he thought, with horror, and he took the chalk. Wait a minute, he said, sitting down to the table. I've long wanted to ask you one thing. He looked straight into her caressing, though frightened eyes. Please ask it. Here, he said, and he wrote the initials, WYTMICNBDTMNOT. These letters meant, when you told me it could never be, did that mean never or then? There seemed no likelihood that she could make out this complicated sentence, but he looked at her as though his life depended on her understanding the words. She glanced at him seriously, then leaned her puckered brow on her hands and began to write. Once or twice, she stole a look at him as though asking him, "Is it what I think it is?" "I understand," she said, flushing. "What is this word?" he said, pointing to the N that stood for never. "It means never," she said, "but that's not true." He quickly rubbed out what he had written, gave her the chalk, and stood up. She wrote, T-I-C-N-A-D. Dolly was completely comforted in the depression caused by her conversation with Alexey Alexandrovich when she caught sight of the two figures, Kitty with the chalk in her hand, with a shy and happy smile looking upward at Levin, and his handsome figure bending over the table with glowing eyes, fastened one minute on the table and the next on her. He was suddenly radiant. He had understood. It meant, then I could not answer differently. He glanced at her questioningly, timidly. Only then? Yes, her smile answered. And now, he asked. Well, read this. I'll tell you what I should like so much. She wrote the initial letters, I-Y-C-F-A-F-W-H. This meant, if you could forgive and forget what happened. He snatched the chalk with nervous, trembling fingers and, breaking it, wrote the initial letters of the following phrase, I have nothing to forget and to forgive. I have never ceased to love you. She glanced at him with a smile that did not waver. I understand, she said in a whisper. He sat down and wrote a long phrase. She understood it all, and without asking him, is it this? Took the chalk and at once answered. For a long while he could not understand what she had written and often looked into her eyes. He was stupefied with happiness. He could not supply the words she had meant, but in her charming eyes, beaming with happiness, he saw all he needed to know. And he wrote three letters, but he had hardly finished writing them when she read them over her arm and herself finished and wrote the answer, yes. You're playing secretaire, said the old prince, but we must really be getting along if you want to be in time at the theater. Levin got up and escorted Kitty to the door. In their conversation, everything had been said. It had been said that she loved him and that she would tell her father and mother that he would come tomorrow morning. Chapter 14. When Kitty had gone and Levin was left alone, he felt such uneasiness without her and such an impatient longing to get as quickly as possible to tomorrow morning, when he would see her again and be plighted to her forever, that he felt afraid, as though of death, of those 14 hours that he had to get through without her. It was essential for him to be with someone to talk to, so as not to be left alone, to deceive time. Stepan Arkadyevich would have been the companion most congenial to him, but he was going out, he said, to a soirée, in reality to the ballet. Levin only had time to tell him he was happy and that he loved him and would never, never forget what he had done for him. The eyes and the smile of Stepan Arkadyevich showed Levin that he comprehended that feeling fittingly. Oh, so it's not time to die yet, said Stepan Arkadyevich, pressing Levin's hand with emotion. No, said Levin. Darya Alexandrovna, too, as she said goodbye to him, gave him a sort of congratulation, saying, how glad I am you have met Kitty again. One must value old friends. Levin did not like these words of Darya Alexandrovna's. She could not understand how lofty and beyond her it all was, and she ought not to have dared to allude to it. Levin said goodbye to them, but not to be left alone, he attached himself to his brother. Where are you going? I'm going to a meeting. Well, I'll come with you, may I? What for? Yes, come along, said Sergei Ivanovich, smiling. What is the matter with you today? With me? Happiness is the matter with me, said Levin, letting down the window of the carriage they were driving in. You don't mind. It's so stifling. Happiness is all that matters with me. Why is it you have never married? Sergei Ivanovich smiled. I am very glad. She seems a lovely girl. Sergei Ivanovich was beginning. Don't say it, don't say it, shouted Levin, clutching at the collar of his fur coat with both hands and muffling him up in it. She's a lovely girl, were such simple, humble words, so out of harmony with his feelings. Sergei Ivanovich laughed outright, a merry laugh, which was rare with him. Well, anyway, I may say that I'm very glad of it. That you may do tomorrow, and say no more. Nothing, nothing, silence, said Levin. And muffling him once more in his fur coat, he added, I do like you so. Well, is it possible for me to be present at the meeting? Of course it is. What is your discussion about today? Asked Levin, never ceasing smiling. They arrived at the meeting. Levin heard the secretary hesitatingly read the minutes, which he obviously did not himself understand. But Levin saw from his secretary's face what a good, fine, kind-hearted person he was. This was evident from his confusion and embarrassment in reading the minutes. Then the discussion began. They were disputing about the reckoning off of certain sums and the laying of certain pipes, and Sergei Ivanovich was very cutting to two members and said something at great length with an air of triumph, and another member, scribbling something on a bit of paper, began timidly at first, but afterward answered him very viciously and delightfully. And then Sviashki, he was there also, said something too, very handsomely and nobly. Levin listened to them and saw clearly that this reckoning off of sums and these pipes were not anything real, and that they were not at all angry, but were all the finest, kindest people, and everything was as happy and charming as possible among them. They did no harm to anyone, and were all enjoying it. What struck Levin was that he could see through them all today, and from little, almost imperceptible signs knew the soul of each, and saw distinctly that they were all good at heart, and they were all extremely fond of Levin, in particular that day. This was evident from the way they spoke to him, from the friendly, affectionate way even those whom he did not know looked at him. "Well, are you contented with it?" Sergei Ivanovich asked him. "Very much. I never supposed it was so interesting. Nice. Capital." Sviashky went up to Levin and invited him to come round to tea with him. Levin was utterly at a loss to comprehend or recall what it was he had disliked in Sviashky, what he had failed to find in him. He was a clever and wonderfully good-hearted man. "Most delighted," he said, and asked after his wife and sister-in-law. And from a queer association of ideas, because in his imagination the idea of Sviashky's sister-in-law was connected with marriage, it occurred to him that there was no one to whom he could more suitably speak of his happiness than to Sviashky's wife and sister-in-law, and he was very glad to go to see them. Sviashky questioned him about his improvements on his estate, presupposing, as he always did, that there was no possibility of doing anything not done already in Europe, and now this did not in the least annoy Levin. On the contrary, he felt that Sviashky was right, that the whole business was of little value, and he saw the wonderful suavity and consideration with which Sviashky avoided fully expressing his correct view. The ladies of the Sviashky household were particularly delightful. It seemed to Levin that they knew all about it already and had sympathized with him, saying nothing merely out of delicacy. He stayed with them 1 hour, two, three, talking of all sorts of subjects, but implied in it the only thing that filled his heart, and did not observe that he was boring them dreadfully, and that it was long past their bedtime. Sviashky went with him into the hall, yawning and wondering at the strange humor his friend was in. It was past 1 o'clock. Levin went back to his hotel and was dismayed at the thought that all alone now with his impatience, he had 10 hours still left to get through. The servant, whose turn it was to be up all night, lighted his candles and would have gone away, but Levin stopped him. This servant, Igor, whom Levin had not noticed before, struck him with a very intelligent, excellent, and above all, a good-hearted man. "Well, Igor, it's hard work not sleeping, isn't it? What's to be done? It's part of our work, you see. In a gentleman's house it's easier, but then here one makes more." It appeared that Igor had a family, 3 boys and a daughter, a seamstress, whom he wanted to marry to a cashier in a saddler's shop. Levin, on hearing this, informed Igor that, in his opinion, in marriage the great thing was love, and that with love one would always be happy, for happiness rests only on oneself. Igor listened attentively and obviously quite took in Levin's idea, but by way of assent to it he enunciated, greatly to Levin's surprise, the observation that when he had lived with good masters, he had always been satisfied with his masters, and now was perfectly satisfied with his employer, though he was a Frenchman. "Wonderfully good-hearted fellow," thought Levin. "Well, but you yourself, Igor, when you got married, did you love your wife?" "Aye, and why not?" responded Igor. And Levin saw that Igor, too, was in an excited state and intending to express all his most heartfelt emotions. "My life, too, has been a wonderful one, from a child up." He was beginning with flashing eyes, apparently catching Levin's enthusiasm, just as people catch yawning. But at that moment a ring was heard. Igor departed, and Levin was left alone. He had eaten scarcely anything at dinner, had refused tea and supper at Sviashky's, but he was incapable of thinking of supper. He had not slept the previous night, but was incapable of thinking of sleep either. His room was cold, but he was oppressed by heat. He opened both the movable panes in his windows and sat down on the table opposite the open panes. Over the snow-covered roofs could be seen a decorated cross with chains, and above it the rising triangle of Auriga, with the yellowish light of Capella. He gazed at the cross, then at the star, drank in the fresh, freezing air that flowed evenly into the room, and followed as though in a dream the images and memories that rose in his imagination. At 4 o'clock he heard steps in the passage and peeked out of the door. It was the gambler, Niaskin, whom he knew coming from the club. He walked gloomily, frowning and coughing. Poor, unlucky fellow, thought Levin, and tears came into his eyes from love and pity for this man. He would have talked with him and tried to comfort him, but remembering that he had nothing but his shirt on, he changed his mind and sat down again at the open pane to bathe in the cold air and gaze at the exquisite lines of the cross, silent but full of meaning for him, in the mounting, lurid yellow star. At 6 o'clock there was a noise of people polishing the floors and church bells ringing to some divine service, and Levin felt that he was beginning to get frozen. He closed the pane, washed, dressed, and went out into the street. Chapter 15. The streets were still empty. Levin went to the house of Shabatsky's. The visitors' doors were closed and everything was asleep. He walked back, went into his room again, and asked for coffee. The day servant, not Igor this time, brought it to him. Levin would have entered into conversation with him, but a bell rang for the servant and he went out. Levin tried to drink coffee and take a bite of a roll, but his mouth was quite at a loss what to do with the roll. Levin, rejecting the roll, put on his coat and went out again for a walk. It was 9 o'clock when he reached the Shcherbatsky steps the second time. In the house they were only just up, and the cook came out to go marketing. He had to get through at least 2 hours more. All that night and morning Levin lived perfectly unconsciously and felt perfectly lifted out of the conditions of material life. He had eaten nothing for a whole day. He had not slept for 2 nights. Had spent several hours undressed in the frozen air, and felt not only fresher and stronger than ever, but felt utterly independent of his body. He moved without muscular effort, and felt as if he could do anything. He was convinced he could fly upward or lift the corner of the house if need be. He spent the remainder of the time in the street, incessantly looking at his watch and gazing about him. And what he saw then, he never saw again after. Especially the children going to school, the blue-gray doves fluttering down from the roofs to the pavement, and the little loaves covered with flour set out by an unseen hand touched him. Those loaves, those doves, and those two boys were not of this earth. It all happened at the same time. A boy ran toward a dove and glanced smiling at Levin. The dove, with a whir of her wings, darted away, flashing in the sun, amid grains of snow that quivered in the air. While from a little window there came a smell of fresh-baked bread and the loaves were set out. All of this together was so extraordinarily resplendent that Levin laughed and cried with delight. Going a long way round by Gazetny Lane and Kislovka, he went back again to the hotel and, putting his watch before him, sat down to wait for 12 o'clock. In the next room they were talking about some sort of machines and swindling and coughing their morning coughs. They did not realize that the hand was near 12. The hand reached it. Levin went out on the steps. The sleigh drivers clearly knew all about it. They crowded round Levin with happy faces, quarreling among themselves and offering their services. Trying not to offend the other sleigh drivers and promising to drive with them too, Levin took one and told him to drive to the Shcherbatskys. The sleigh driver was splendid in a white shirt collar sticking out over his overcoat, and into his strong, full-blooded red neck. The sleigh was high and comfortable, and altogether such a one as Levin never drove in after, and the horse was a good one and tried to gallop, yet didn't seem to move. The driver knew the Shcherbatsky's house and drew up at the entrance, squaring his arms and saying a woe, especially indicative of respect for his fare. The Shcherbatsky's hall porter certainly knew all about it. This was evident from the smile in his eyes and the way he said, "Well, it's a long while since you've been to see us, Konstantin Dmitrievich." Not only did he know all about it, but he was unmistakably delighted and making efforts to conceal his joy. Looking into his kindly old eyes, Levin realized even something new in his happiness. "Are they up? Pray, walk in. Leave it here," said he, smiling, as Levin would have come back to take his hat. That meant something. "To whom shall I announce your honor?" asked the footman. The footman, though a young man and one of the new school of footmen, a dandy, was a very kind-hearted good fellow, and he too knew all about it. "The princess, the prince, the young princess," said Levin. The first person he saw was Mademoiselle Linen. She walked across the room, and her ringlets and her face were beaming. He had barely spoken to her when suddenly he heard the rustle of a skirt at the door, and Mademoiselle Linen vanished from Levin's eyes, and a joyful terror came over him at the nearness of his happiness. Mademoiselle Linen was in great haste, and leaving him, went out at the other door. Directly she had gone out, swift, swift light steps sounded on the parquet, and his bliss, his life, his own self, what was best in himself, what he had so long sought and longed for, was quickly, so quickly approaching him. She did not walk, but seemed, by some unseen force, to float toward him. He saw nothing but her clear, truthful eyes, frightened by the same bliss of love that flooded his heart. Those eyes were shining nearer and nearer, blinding him with their light of love. She stopped close to him, touching him. Her hands rose and dropped on his shoulders. She had done all she could. She had run up to him and given herself up entirely, shy and happy. He put his arms round her and pressed his lips to her mouth, which sought his kiss. She, too, had not slept all night and had been expecting him all the morning. Her mother and father had consented without demur and were happy in her happiness. She had been waiting for him. She wanted to be the first to tell him her happiness and his. She had got ready to see him alone and had been delighted at the idea, and had been shy and ashamed and did not know herself what she was to do. She had heard his steps and voice and had waited at the door for Mademoiselle Linen to go. Mademoiselle Linen had gone away, without thinking, without asking herself how and what. She had gone up to him and did as she was doing. "Let us go to Mama," she said, taking him by the hand. For a long while he could say nothing, not so much because he was afraid of desecrating the loftiness of his emotion by a word, as that every time he tried to say something, instead of words, he felt that tears of happiness were welling up. He took her hand and kissed it. "Can it be true?" he said at last in a choked voice. "I can't believe you love me, dear." She smiled at that dear and at the timidity with which he glanced at her. "Yes," she said significantly, deliberately, "I am so happy." Without letting go his hand, she went into the drawing room. The princess, seeing them, breathed quickly and immediately began to cry, and then immediately began to laugh, and with a vigorous step Levin had not expected, ran up to him and, hugging his head, kissed him, wetting his cheeks with her tears. "So it is all settled. I am glad. Love her. I am glad, Kitty." "You've not been long settling things," said the old prince, trying to seem unmoved, but Levin noticed that his eyes were wet when he turned to him. "I've long, always wished for this," said the prince, taking Levin by the arm and drawing him toward himself. "Even when this featherhead fancied..." "Papa!" shrieked Kitty, and shut his mouth with her hands. "Well, I won't," he said. "I'm very, very pleased. Oh, what a fool I am." He embraced Kitty, kissed her face, her hand, her face again, and made the sign of the cross over her. And there came over Levin a new feeling of love for this man, the old prince, till then so little known to him, when he saw how slowly and tenderly Kitty kissed his muscular hand. Chapter 16. The princess was sitting in her armchair, silent and smiling. The prince sat down beside her. Kitty stood by her father's chair, still holding his hand. All were silent. The princess was the first to put everything into words and to translate all thoughts and feelings into practical questions, and all felt equally strange and painful for the first minute. "When is it to be? We must have the benediction and announcement. And when's the wedding to be? What do you think, Alexandra?" "Here he is," said the old prince, pointing to Levin. "He's the principal person in the matter." "When?" said Levin, blushing. "Tomorrow. If you ask me, I should say the benediction today and the wedding tomorrow." "Come, mon cher, that's nonsense." "Well, in a week?" "He's quite mad." "No, why so?" "Well, upon my word," said the mother, smiling delighted at his haste, "how about the trousseau?" "Will there really be a trousseau and all that?" Levin thought with horror. "But can the trousseau and the benediction and all that, can it spoil my happiness? Nothing can spoil it." He glanced at Kitty and noticed that she was not in the least, not in the very least, disturbed by the idea of the trousseau. "Then it must be all right," he thought. "Oh, I know nothing about it. I only said what I should like," he said apologetically. "We'll talk it over, then. The benediction and announcement can take place now. That's very well." The princess went up to her husband, kissed him, and would have gone away, but he held her back, embraced her, and tenderly, as a young lover, kissed her several times, smiling. The old people were obviously muddled for a moment and did not quite know whether it was they who were in love again or their daughter. When the prince and princess had gone, Levin went up to his betrothed and took her hand. He was self-possessed now and could speak, and he had a great deal he wanted to tell her, but he did not say at all what he had to say. "How I knew it would be so, I never hoped for it, and yet in my heart I was always sure," he said. "I believe that it was ordained." "And I," she said, even when she stopped and went on again, looking at him resolutely with her truthful eyes, "even when I thrust my happiness from me, I always loved you only, but I was carried away. I ought to tell you. Can you forgive it?" "Perhaps it was for the best. You will have to forgive me so much. I ought to tell you." This was one of the things he had meant to speak about. He had resolved from the first to tell her two things, that he was not chaste as she was, and that he was not a believer. It was agonizing, but he considered he ought to tell her both these facts. "No, not now, later," he said. "Very well, later, but you must certainly tell me. I'm not afraid of anything. I want to know everything. Now it is settled," he added. "Settled that you'll take me, whatever I may be? You won't give me up? Yes? Yes, yes." Their conversation was interrupted by Mademoiselle Linen, who with an affected but tender smile came to congratulate her favorite pupil. Before she had gone, the servants came in with their congratulations. Then relations arrived, and there began that state of blissful absurdity from which Levin did not emerge till the day after his wedding. Levin was in a continual state of awkwardness and discomfort, but the intensity of his happiness went on increasing all the while. He felt continually that a great deal was being expected of him. What, he did not know. And he did everything he was told, and it all gave him happiness. He had thought his engagement would have nothing about it like others, that the ordinary conditions of engaged couples would spoil this special happiness. But it ended in his doing exactly as other people did, and his happiness being only increased thereby and becoming more and more special, more and more unlike anything that had ever happened. "Now we shall have sweetmeats to eat," said Mademoiselle Linen, and Levin drove off to buy sweetmeats. "Well, I am very glad," said Sviashky. "I advise you to get the bouquets from Fomin's." "Oh, are they wanted?" And he drove to Fomin's. His brother recommended lending money to him, as he would have so many expenses, presents to give. "Oh, are presents wanted?" And he galloped to Foles. And at the confectioner's, and at Froman's, and at Foles, he saw that he was expected, that they were pleased to see him and prided themselves on his happiness, just as everyone did whom he had to do with during those days. What was extraordinary was that everyone not only liked him, but even people previously unsympathetic, cold, and callous, were enthusiastic over him, gave way to him in everything, treated his feelings with tenderness and delicacy, and shared his conviction that he was the happiest man in the world because his betrothed was beyond perfection. Kitty, too, felt the same thing. When Countess Nordstone ventured to hint that she had hoped for something better, Kitty was so angry and proved so conclusively that nothing in the world could be better than Levin that Countess Nordstone had to admit it, and in Kitty's presence never met Levin without a smile of ecstatic admiration. The confession he had promised was the one painful incident of this time. He consulted the old prince and with his sanction gave Kitty his diary, in which there was written the confession that tortured him. He had written this diary at the time with a view to his future wife. Two things caused him anguish, his lack of purity and his lack of faith. His confession of unbelief passed unnoticed. She was religious, had never doubted the truth of religion, but his external unbelief did not affect her in the least. Through love, he knew all his soul, and in his soul she saw what she wanted, and that such a state of soul should be called unbelieving was to her a matter of no account. The other confession set her weeping bitterly. Levin, not without an inner struggle, handed her his diary. He knew that between him and her there could not be and should not be any secrets, and so he had decided that so it must be. But he had not realized what an effect it would have on her. He had not put himself in her place. It was only when the same evening he came to their house before the theater, went into her room and saw her tear-stained, pitiful, sweet face, miserable with the suffering he had caused and nothing could undo, that he felt the abyss that separated his shameful past from her dove-like purity and was appalled at what he had done. "Take them. Take these dreadful books," she said, pushing away the notebooks lying before her on the table. "Why did you give them me? No, it was better anyway," she added, touched by his despairing face. "But it's awful, awful." His head sank and he was silent. He could say nothing. "You can't forgive me," he whispered. "Yes, I forgive you, but it's horrible." But his happiness was so immense that this confession did not shatter it. It only added another shade to it. She forgave him, but from that time more than ever he considered himself unworthy of her, morally bowed down lower than ever before her, and prized more highly than ever his undeserved happiness. Chapter 17. Unconsciously going over his memory the conversations that had taken place during and after dinner, Alexey Alexandrovich returned to his solitary room. Darya Alexandrovna's words about forgiveness had roused in him nothing but annoyance. The applicability or non-applicability of the Christian precept to his own case was too difficult a question to be discussed lightly, and this question had long ago been answered by Alexey Alexandrovich in the negative. Of all that had been said, what struck most in his memory was the phrase of stupid, good-natured Turovtsin. "Acted like a man," he did, called him out and shot him. Everyone had apparently shared his feeling, though from politeness they had not expressed it. "But the matter is settled. It's useless thinking about it," Alexey Alexandrovich told himself. And thinking of nothing but the journey before him and the revision work he had to do, he went into his room and asked the porter who escorted him where his man was. The porter said that the man had just gone out. Alexey Alexandrovich ordered tea to be sent him, sat down to the table, and taking the schedule, began considering the route of his journey. "Two telegrams," said his valet, coming into the room. "I beg your pardon, Your Excellency. I just stepped out this very minute." Alexey Alexandrovich took the telegrams and opened them. The first telegram was the announcement of Stremov's appointment to the very post Karenin had coveted. Alexey Alexandrovich flung the telegram down and, flushing, got up and began to pace up and down the room. "Quo volt per der dimittat," he said, meaning by quos the persons responsible for this appointment. He was not so much annoyed at not receiving the post as at having been so conspicuously passed over, but it was incomprehensible. Amazing to him that they did not see that the wordy phrase-monger Stremov was the last man fit for it. How could they fail to see they were ruining themselves, lowering their prestige by this appointment? Something else in the same line, he said to himself bitterly, opening the second telegram. The telegram was from his wife. Her name, written in blue pencil, Anna, was the first thing that caught his eye. "I am dying. I beg, I implore you to come. I shall die easier with your forgiveness," he read. He smiled contemptuously and flung down the telegram. That this was a trick and a fraud, of that, he thought for the first minute, there could be no doubt. There is no deceit she would stick at. She was near her confinement. Perhaps it is the confinement. But what can be their aim? To legitimize the child, to compromise me and prevent a divorce, he thought. But something was said in it. "I am dying." He read the telegram again, and suddenly the plain meaning of what was said in it struck him. "And if it is true," he said to himself, "if it is true that in the moment of agony and nearness to death, she is genuinely penitent, and I, taking it for a trick, refuse to go, that would not only be cruel, and everyone would blame me, but it would be stupid on my part. Peter, call a coach. I am going to Petersburg," he said to his servant. Alexey Alexandrovich decided he would go to Petersburg and see his wife. If her illness was a trick, he would say nothing and go away again. If she were really in danger and wished to see him before her death, he would forgive her if he found her alive and pay her the last duties if he came too late. All the way he thought no more of what he ought to do. With a sense of weariness and uncleanness from the night spent in the train, in the early fog of Petersburg, Alexey Alexandrovich drove through the deserted Nevsky Prospect and stared straight before him without thinking of what was awaiting him. He could not think about it because in picturing what would happen, he could not drive away the reflection that her death would at once remove all the difficulty of his position. Bakers, closed shops, night cabmen, street sweepers sweeping the pavements flashed past his eyes, and he watched it all, trying to smother the thought of what was awaiting him and what he dared not hope for and yet was hoping for. He drove up to the steps. A hackney sleigh and a coach with its coachman asleep stood at the entrance. As he went into the entry, Alexey Alexandrovich seemed to get out his resolution from the remotest corner of his brain, and mastered it thoroughly. Its meaning ran, "If it's a trick, then calm, contempt, and departure. If truth, do what is seemly." The porter opened the door before Alexey Alexandrovich rang. The porter, Kapitanich, looked queer in an old coat without a tie and in slippers. How is your mistress? She was confined yesterday, successfully. Alexey Alexandrovich stopped short and turned white. He felt distinctly now how intensely he had longed for her death. And how is she? Corney, in this morning apron, ran downstairs. Very ill, he answered. There was a consultation yesterday, and the doctor's here now. Take my things, said Alexey Alexandrovich, and feeling some relief at the news that there was still hope of her death, he went into the hall. On the hat stand, there was a military overcoat. Alexey Alexandrovich noticed it and asked, who is here? The doctor, the midwife, and Count Vronsky. Alexey Alexandrovich went into the inner rooms. In the drawing room, there was no one. At the sound of his steps, the midwife came out of Anna's boudoir in a cap with lilac ribbons. She went up to Alexey Alexandrovich and, with the familiarity given by the approach of death, took him by the arm and drew him toward the bedroom. Thank God you've come. She keeps on talking about you and nothing but you, she said. Make haste with the ice, the doctor's peremptory voice came from the bedroom. Alexey Alexandrovich went into the boudoir. At her table, sitting sideways in a low chair, was Vronsky, his face hidden in his hands, weeping. He jumped up at the doctor's voice, took his hands from his face, and saw Alexey Alexandrovich.